This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 11th of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Midori House, in association with Montclair. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Robert Bounds. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, President Obama continues his search for his new cabinet. With a number of nominations under his belt this week, he now needs to wait for the US Senate to approve his choices. We ask, is the public scrutiny good for government, or should the Americans follow the British model? One of Somalia's most notorious pirates is finally calling it quits. Is this the beginning of the end for piracy on the high seas? In the wake of that picture of the Duchess of Cambridge, we ask, what makes a good portrait? We'll speak to someone who's painted four decades of Britain's royal family. And we head to the Pacific Rim to find out where you can eat Hong Kong milk tea and French toast early in the morning, just like the locals.
Traditional tea restaurants like ours are vanishing. Those that remain have pushed their prices up and quality has gone down. Rent is the biggest problem. Many tea restaurants, some even with Michelin stars, couldn't keep going.
All that, plus we'll play some expertly chosen music too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. US President Barack Obama is in the process of selecting a new cabinet for his second term. He's already made several high-profile appointments, including John Kerry for Secretary of State, Chuck Hagel for Defence, Jack Lew for the Treasury, and John Brennan to head the CIA. However, none of these candidates have been confirmed just yet. That responsibility rests with the Senate, who need to give the nod. The process can be swift, but sometimes the hearings can be politically very damaging. It's a much different process on this side of the pond. Here in the UK, the Prime Minister can appoint whomever he wishes to his cabinet. Joining us now to discuss the merits of both systems is John Rentall from The Independent. John, welcome to Midori House.
Hello, good evening.
So, first of all, we should maybe have a look at some of these usual suspects, or the current suspects that Obama's put up for office. Let's head first to Chuck Hagel for Defence and John Brennan for the CIA, two perhaps of the most controversial decisions. What's been the discussion across the American media?
Well, the controversial one is Hagel at Defence, because he's considered to be too sort of anti-Israel, by which, you know, in American political language, people mean, you know, he's not totally 100% pro-Israel. I think John Kerry as Secretary of State has been quite controversial, just because he's such a boring appointment. Because Kerry's another white bloke replacing Hillary, who was different and fresh. So I think they've all been controversial. I haven't followed the latest controversy on Brennan at the CIA, but these appointments are going to have critics and supporters.
And it seems that obviously Obama and US presidents are in the habit of putting their names into the public hat. What can be gained from this? I mean, obviously there's been a lot of discussion. We're talking about it now. It's been happening a lot in the US press and on US TV and radio as well, of course. What's to be gained from that? Can you get a gauge of how popular the policies and the people are going to be in your cabinet, I guess?
Well, yes. I mean, it's a curious process, because we saw with the non-nomination of Susan Rice how it works, that a name sort of leaks into the sort of public space. People start discussing it as if it's a possibility. People start putting arguments for and against the name before the nomination's actually made. And in Susan Rice's case, the nomination wasn't actually made, but it was plainly being considered by the president and by Rice herself.
And obviously it's done in a slightly more cloak and dagger way in the UK here. I mean, I guess that has its advantages for someone.
Hold on a minute. Cloak and dagger?
Well, it's done in a... It would surprise US listeners to know that simply someone writes these names down. There's no public discussion until after they're named.
Yeah, but I mean, we have a parliamentary system in this country which operates completely differently, because all the people who are members of the cabinet are elected members of the legislature, so they're MPs who represent constituencies, have been in Parliament for some time, and therefore have been in the public eye for a long time. You know, unlike in America, where people can be plucked from relative obscurity to be put in the cabinet, with the media and the press having very little idea of their background and the arguments for and against. You know, the people who are put in the cabinet in this country are front rank politicians who've been subjected to media scrutiny for years, usually.
But I guess scrutiny is one thing. Suitability is a different one, isn't there? I guess be it going from one department to a very different department within the British cabinet is no better test, I suppose, than simply being plucked from maybe business like in the US.
Yeah, I mean, suitability and capability at the job are they're handled differently in the States. I mean, in the States, ultimately, the decision is the president's. I mean, the president nominates, and then it has to pass some kind of sort of quality control threshold in the congressional hearings. Whereas, you know, in our system, you know, the prime minister is constrained by politics and by political factions in his own party and by, you know, what public opinion will make of particular appointments. So it's not as if the Prime Minister has a completely free hand, whereas the President doesn't. I mean, there are constraints in both systems.
And do you think it's more important then for Obama to elect or to nominate some sort of backroom achievers, some strong souls, rather than people that are going to make a big splash?
Yeah, I mean, he wants to do the same as a British Prime Minister. He wants to promote really talented people, but he also needs to. I mean, he needs to make sure that the people he does nominate are capable of getting through the congressional hearing system. And in the same way, a British Prime Minister wants to bring on talent, doesn't want to bring on people who are going to be too much of a threat to his own position. But they have to be people who will go down well with the general public and with their party in Parliament.
All right, John, we'll leave the cloak and dagger to some lesser political systems than ours or the US. John Rental from The Independent, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up next, one of the world's most well-known Somali pirates is hanging up his gun and retiring from what he calls a dirty business. Could we be seeing the end of piracy?
Montclair. Keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Be our guest and come spend the weekend with Monocle 24. We kick off on Saturday with the Weekend Edition, a smart, relaxing selection of music, news headlines and great conversation.
There's real excitement there, you know, and it's sort of like, wow, I don't really understand what they're doing, but I love the sound of it.
Then join us for our brand new show, The Stack, celebrating the world of print media, from chunky Korean glossies to fine-tuned Brazilian newspapers. Hosted by Tyler Brulé, each week we pull in guest reviewers to crack open spines and thumb through inky pages to reveal why there's more to journalism than going digital.
The publication you have in your hand is all about women across the Middle East. The one in your hand is about skiing in Morocco. They have one about the Saudi pavilion in the Osaka Expo. So it was very progressive.
Later, this Saturday review casts a critical eye over the week's literature, music, TV, cinema and the arts and delivers some fun, fast-paced conversation too.
It's a bit of a riot, actually. They just boiled the crayfish in water.
That sounds like a riot so far.
On Sundays, stay over for the Monocle Weekly, our longest-running radio show that brings our editors face-to-face with everyone from academics to war correspondents, historians to social commentators, and serves up some fine music too.
I sort of came to Brazilian music quite late. Yeah, it's something that I'm still discovering.
And don't miss The Curator, our one-hour survey of the week's highlights on Monocle 24. That's the new weekend lineup on Monocle 24.
But for the time being, you are tuned in to Midori House, where it's 18:14 here in London, 21:14 in Mogadishu. Mohamed Abdi Hassan is one of the world's best-known pirates, but after 8 years of raiding and hijacking ships in the Gulf of Aden, he's calling it quits. Big Mouth, as he's also known, made millions of dollars seizing ships, but now he wants to put an end to what he called a dirty business. It comes at a time when pirate attacks are down more than a third because of tough anti-piracy measures and maritime patrols. Could we be seeing an end to the piracy on the high seas, or are pirates simply targeting new parts of the oceans? Joining me now is Stig Jarle Hansen, Associate Professor at the Norwegian University and also author of a new book, which is coming out later this year, aptly named End of Piracy. Stig, thanks for joining us on the line.
Thank you for inviting me, sir.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk about anyone called Big Mouth, Stig. Why is this particular fellow, this king of the Somali pirates, hanging up his AK-47?
I think, firstly, this is very historical, I have to underline, because this is actually the founder of modern Somali piracy and actually one of the most successful pirates in the history of piracy in the East. The western part of the Indian Ocean, compared with the historical characters also like Captain Kidd. So this is an historical day in many ways, but definitively this guy is hanging up and ending his business because of the declining profit rates in that branch, so to say, because increased use of private security, more active patrolling by the International Navy has made the profit drastically dwindle. And we've seen several other pirate leaders before him who said that no, they are diversifying their investments, they are stopping piracy and doing other things. So he's a part of a trend, and the trend has been very poor for the pirates for the last 1.5 years.
So there's a bit of a sort of hard-nosed classic business decision here, Stig, that's getting too risky and the profits aren't high enough to stay operating in this field, right?
Yes, because what we can see, you know, in late 2011, we saw the success rates dwindling quite drastically. So it was less than 1 out of 10 attacks that were successful. And a lot of these successes were scored against local traffic who wasn't really profitable. In addition to that, we can see that the ship owners, they are delaying the ransom payment. And you know, the current ships in the holding of the Somali pirates, they are basically, in general, they have been there for quite a long time. So it seems that these ship owners are quite reluctant to pay, actually. So, you know, basically return of their investments is less profitable. And they have a lot of capital from piracy, so they might just want to invest that capital in other businesses.
He sounds a bit like the sort of James Gandolfini. He sounds like he sounds like he could be in Goodfellas, maybe. Sounds like a proper mafia boss. Maybe to be tempted by one last job out of retirement, this Big Mouth Stig. But presumably there'll be plenty of other young pirates snapping at his heels and wanting to earn the millions that he earned.
No, I actually think that it has been underestimated. The role of these big pirate leaders have been underestimated because people come to them to get work. You know, they organize the attacks, and it's not a primitive business in the sense that you need to have some kind of logistics. So I think we're now seeing the downturn of piracy. You know, there's a big weakness with this plot. You know, these leaders are still free. So Afweni is still free. The other big cartel leaders are still free. They are not captured by anybody. And that means that if it's the gaining profit again, if the sector is, you know, increasingly profitable, that means if the countermeasures against piracy are relaxed, we might just have this problem again. You know, we haven't dealt with the root causes. You know, the downturn now is caused by countermeasures at sea, and now there's an economic downturn. Maybe then, you know, the ship owners will be less willing to invest in countermeasures and pirates. Maybe the international navies will be less willing to provide naval escorts in the area, and then we still have these leaders running around. So you know, maybe it might return in the future. We will see.
But for the time being, maybe you can paint a very quick pencil portrait of what's going on in the Gulf of Aden. I mean, pirate attacks are obviously down. It's a safer body of water than it was.
Yes, it has. First, the success rate declined drastically in the autumn of 2011. And what we've seen last year is that the pirate attacks have declined drastically. What we see is that the navies are more active in stopping hijacked motherships. So basically the navies are freeing hijacked motherships. So there has been more motherships freed last year than the new motherships hijacked also. So it's harder for them to stage the attacks as well. So, you know, no, there's just 100 sailors in Somali captivity, and that's a record low since 2008.
And finally, Stig, is there any concern that pirates are moving to other parts of the world to despoil ships in other straits?
In one sense, yes. We didn't see an increase in piracy around Nigeria, so there wasn't any increase, but the percentage of Nigerian piracy compared to the Somali piracy has increased as a total of world piracy because simply there's less Somali piracy. So no, it seems like Nigerian piracy is gaining in its relative importance. Additional to that, we have some traditional zones, you know, that's still active. We have Bengali piracy. The problem with Bengali piracy is targeting local traffic, so it's so internationally famous. We still have some activities around Singapore and the Straits of Malacca and around the Philippines. It's still there. It was, it's declined a lot from the early 2000s, but it's still there.
All right. Well, Stig Jarle Hansen, thank you very much for joining us. And Stig is author of a new book coming out later in the year called End of Piracy. Now I think it's time to play the aptly named song Big Mouth Strikes Again. It's the Smiths.
Blood.
How good is this show going when you can play Big Mouth Strikes Again? And it ties in perfectly with the news story that was, of course, the Smiths. Now, the first official portrait of the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate Middleton, is already dividing the public. Painted by artist Paul Emsley, the portrait will be available for viewing in the National Gallery. Emsley took several months painting the portrait, for which the Duchess was available on two occasions for sittings. Today, Emsley said he wanted to portray the Duchess in her natural self rather than her official self. But some critics are saying the portrait is a bit too natural, while others say it's disappointing. But what makes a good portrait great? Joining us on the line now is Richard Stone, someone who is in his fourth decade of painting royal portraits. Richard, welcome to the show.
Oh, good evening. Good evening.
Now, first of all, we should talk our way through this portrait of the Duchess of Cambridge. It's obviously whenever a royal portrait is let loose on the public and certainly on the internet, people don't hold their punches, do they? Pull their punches when they're criticising it. Do you like the portrait?
Yes, I do. I saw it this morning, probably around the same time that you did. It has a lot going for it. You remember, we're in an age now where we all have an opinion about someone we see in the newspapers and on TV every single day. So it's not surprising that sort of any new public face that is now hanging in the National Portrait Gallery arouses comment. In fact, it's probably good that it does.
I wonder whether, I mean, liking something and not liking something is all very well, but is there a way that a royal figure should be portrayed? Is there are there tropes and styles, like motifs to royal portraiture, that is different to painting somebody else?
No, not really. Well, I suppose a lot depends on
you have to be nicer.
Where the portrait's ultimately going to go. If you're painting the portrait of the Queen that's going to hang in some august institution, then perhaps the expectation is that you wouldn't paint an informal portrait of her. But the beauty of the National Portrait Gallery is that it is a collection of portraits. And there's something wonderfully refreshing and relaxed about the Duchess of Cambridge that I think the artist has captured. I mean, many years ago, talking about centuries ago, the artist ran the risk of actually losing his head if it wasn't a portrait that met with the approval of the monarch. But, of course, we fortunately don't have those sort of restrictions placed upon us now. I mean, at the end of the day, you, of course, first of all, you want the sitter to like it. Secondly, you sort of hope that the artist is happy with his efforts. And then once, of course, it goes on public display, you know, any artist's picture is going to be the subject of brickbats.
And do you have to think about that when you're painting the portrait, Richard? I mean, obviously, it's going to be there's going to be scrutiny of it. Do you try to push the boundaries? Do you try to be extra truthful, or do you try extra hard to please the sitter?
Do you know, there's probably a bit of all that you've said that goes into it. I mean, first and foremost, if you're a decent artist, an honest artist, being honest with yourself, you're going to paint something that pleases you. As an artist, if you set yourself up as a portrait painter, what you're setting out to do is actually paint a portrait. Then you ask yourself, what is a portrait? A portrait has to be a likeness. Otherwise, you know, it fails dramatically. But what makes a painting different from a photograph? One hopes it has some sort of psychological depth. And that's the beauty that the luxury that the artist has. Insofar as that he has a number of sittings with the subject. And it is during the course of those sittings he's able to observe many expressions, to engage the subject into sort of conversation. How we remember each other, how we recall our friends, in our mind's eye, what we're doing is really sort of having a jigsaw puzzle of different expressions that are amalgamated. So it is a sort of library of memory of their different expressions. And that's really, I suppose, the explanation behind a speaking likeness. And this is, I suppose, the sensitive area when a portrait of a famous person is then exposed to the public. We all bring to it our own sort of preconceived ideas about what he or she is like, either if one has actually met them or in fact just formed an opinion from seeing them on TV and in the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And for me to judge this portrait, is it a picture that engages me? Yes. Is there a feeling of movement and life about it?
Yeah.
Yes. It's already beginning to tick those boxes. So in my book, it is a good picture.
Well, Richard Stone, Royal Portrait Artist, thank you very much for joining us. I'm glad that Paul Emsley, the painter of this particular portrait, didn't feel like he should put Kate on a horse or maybe climbing out of a Range Rover or a helicopter. You are tuned in, in fact, to Midori House.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong, Zurich,
London.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be finding out why clothing giant retailer H&M is branching out into the high-end market and what are this year's must-see from the theatre world. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
The international mediator Lakhdar Brahimi and senior envoys from Russia and the United States have called for a political solution to end Syria's crisis, but have so far reached no breakthrough. In other developments, opposition sources in Syria say rebel forces have seized control of one of the country's largest helicopter bases. It's believed to be their first capture of a military airfield used by President Bashar al-Assad's forces. President François Hollande says French troops are taking part in operations against Islamists in northern Mali. Mr. Hollande said French troops had brought support to the Malian army to fight against the terrorists. He said the intervention was in line with international law. President Barack Obama and Afghan President Hamid Karzai have begun a crucial round of talks that are expected to help determine how fast the United States withdraws troops from Afghanistan and whether it leaves a residual force after 2014. And the UN nuclear agency chief says he's not optimistic about talks with Iran next week on getting access to a military base Western powers suspect has been used for atom bomb-related work. And America's aviation watchdog has ordered a comprehensive review of the Boeing 787 Dreamliner after a spate of incidents involving the new aircraft model. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
And now it's 18:31 in London. We're going to have time for another song. This is Roses by Tatiana Kochareva.
We'll be right back.
And that was Roses by Tatiana Kocharova, and you're tuned in to Midori House. OK, it's 18:35 here in London. All week we've been examining what we can expect in the world of art, literature and all the rest of that good cultural stuff. To wrap up our series, we're now joined by Matt Wolfe, London theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, to find out what we've seen, what we're going to see this year in the world of theatre. What we've seen, what we're going to see, I think, Matt.
Yeah, we're going to see a lot of really interesting stuff. Very diverse, as always in London.
Always diverse. By the way, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Rob.
A familiar voice to Monocle 24 listeners. Well, it's nice to have you on Midori House for
once. Be back. Good to see you.
So you flagged up a few items of discussion.
Yeah.
The first thing is old times. Does this mirror the diversity that we can see this year?
Well, it certainly will be an interesting event because what they want are punters to see it twice. Why do they want punters to see it twice? Because the two women in it, both of whom are pretty amazing, Kristen Scott Thomas and Leah Williams, are going to be swapping roles. So there will be one performance a week out of the eight where which actress plays which role will be decided by a coin toss on the night, and the other seven performances will be on the web or at the box office or whatever. And that's actually really clever because it means if you like the production, you like it so much, you'll see it again. And, you know, I think they're both great actresses. It must be fun for Rufus Sewell because he gets to play opposite both the women in both the roles.
Right. So it's a testing thing. So this was done with Johnny Lee Miller and I'm going to forget the other, in Frankenstein, where they swap roles every night, was it?
Or exactly. I mean, there is a precedent for this. Yeah. And there have been, you know, productions of Shakespeare way back when where they swapped over. Johnny Lee Miller and Benedict Cumberbatch had actually really worked. And, you know, the thing was that you'd see one as the monster and the other as the doctor or the other way around. And it's a good hook. In the case of, this is a 1971 play by Harold Pinter, who's, of course, no longer living, but was one of the great dramatists of our time and is playing at the Harold Pinter Theater. So it's got an apt home. It does sort of make sense in this production for the women to do that because it's about a guy and his wife and this other woman who comes into their lives, and it's a memory play where you're not ever quite sure about what exactly has happened, or does it just exist in the memory? And there are a lot of people who think that the women are actually two versions of the same person. So it should be really appropriate, and it should also be really sexy and fun.
And I like the idea of that. I mean, do you think, looking into your theatrical crystal ball, or your critic's crystal ball at least, Matt, do you feel people will find it sort of a tonic to some of those kind of, you know, midwinter blues, or will they think it's slightly gimmicky?
No, I think they'll find it
two actresses for the price of two.
Yeah. Well put, Rob. Very good. I think they'll find it a definite tonic. Kristen Scott Thomas, by the way, did do a Pinter play on the West End 2 years ago, Betrayal, very beautifully at the same theater with the same director, Ian Rickson. So this is terrain that she knows well, that she's very familiar with. But it basically means that she and Lee Williams have to memorize the entire female component of the play. But hey, why not? Somebody's got to.
And isn't it time? I mean, we've sort of wondered whether it's a gimmick or not, but should not theatre be pushing some of these boundaries? We always think if it's something that cinema does, whether it does it very well or not, but it's nice to see theatre showing a bit of, sort of entrepreneurial nous as well.
Yeah, right? And also major actresses exerting a lot of muscle. I mean, memory muscle, for one thing. You often hear when actors reach a certain age, oh, I can't remember my lines anymore. It's the first thing they say. Well, maybe if they had done this at a younger age, their memory would be absolutely sharp as can be.
I want you to get memory muscle on the poster for this.
Okay. That'll be my test for 2013, Rob. Thank you.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, now that, I mean, I think every list of upcoming, scintillating events should have a musical. Yeah. 2012 was a dismal year for musicals, which ended calamitously with the back-to-back double whammy of Viva Forever and The Bodyguard. So 2013 can only improve. And we've got The Book of Mormon, which is the one that probably has the most box office, once A Chorus Line. But Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is a world premiere. Of course, we know the story from films and from the Roald Dahl, but it's never been done as a stage musical before. It's starring Douglas Hodge, who, of course, is a wonderful actor of stage and screen and telly. It's directed by Sam Mendes, who directed Skyfall. It's got a score by the team behind the show Hairspray, which was a wonderful success on Broadway and in London. And it should be an extravaganza, but an extravaganza that's smart. Like, you can take the kids without checking your brain at home.
And Douglas Hodge is playing Willy Wonka.
Willy Wonka.
That's right. That's quite an unusual choice. He's normally quite a Peter Pan kind of figure. Douglas Hodge is a fantastic actor, but he's quite a sort of a stolid presence, perhaps.
Yes.
I don't know. Am I being unfair?
No. I mean, he's an earthy, robust presence. I mean, it's interesting because
good, yeah.
about 10 or 15 years ago, he was more frequently found doing the plays of Pinter and Chekhov. You know, in fact, 10 or 15 years ago, he would have been wonderful in Old Times, or actually he could even do it now. But he was in a revival of La Cage aux Folles a couple of years ago, the Broadway show, which he did here and then on Broadway. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, he also sings and very well, and he composes, and here's a chance for him to do something brand new.
And with a production like this, presumably people's eyes will very much be on the sets and some of the effects as well, right?
I mean, I think the hope is that it won't just be about the effects. Very often you see this kind of a show and you go, well, the effects were great, or, you know, the chandelier was fun, or the barricades were nice, but I can't hum a single tune and I don't remember a single performance. I think Sam Mendes, you know, being at the helm of this, he did run the Donmar for 10 years. He is a theater man who's found success in movies. It should be a good evening.
We'll move it along to Peter and Alice. Madness.
Yeah, Peter and Alice. Well, you know, one of the reasons to go to the theater in Britain is to see the wonderful Judi Dench, who, of course, is in Skyfall as M. But long before she was M, she was a shining light of the British stage. She's not far off 80, I don't think she'll mind me saying. And one wonders, at this point in her illustrious career, just how many more stage plays she's going to do. This is a world premiere, again, by the American writer John Logan. He began as a playwright, but he then went on to write movies like Gladiator and Sweeney Todd. But his heart is in the theater. The last play he did in London and on Broadway was a two-hander called Red, about the painter Mark Rothko, which was a huge success. And this is his first new play since then. I gather it tells sort of the backstory of the Peter Pan's saga. And Judi Dench is the inspiration for Peter in that whole scenario. The other leading actor in it is Ben Whishaw, who's Q in the Bond films. So it's a bit of a Bond reunion. And, you know, Ben was Hamlet at the Old Vic years ago, then found fame as a movie star, and now he's going back to the theatrical well.
And there seems to be a lot of this. Sam Mendes going back, Judi Dench and Ben Whishaw. There seems to be a lot of, maybe people are breathing a sigh of relief after maybe putting some decent paychecks in their pockets last year.
I think so. And I mean, Skyfall, you know, a lot of people say it's the best Bond film ever. But a lot of people who segue from theater to film, it is just a paycheck deal. And the films are really bad and they come back to the theater for nourishment. In the case of Dench and Mendes and others, they're able to find satisfaction both. But Judi Dench has always said she lives for the theater and that she will, you know, end her days as an actress on stage.
And presumably this will be an incredibly hot, a none more hot ticket, seeing one of our, perhaps our greatest theatrical dame up there.
Yes, I think the only possible rival in the hot ticket sweepstakes is the other dame who's coming to the West End.
There's nothing like a dame.
Except there are loads of them at the moment. They're all on a travelator of dames, a dame-a-later.
But, a dame-a-later.
There we go.
We've got to stop the clock. We've got to write this down.
Get that patent out.
Yes.
And I'm referring, of course, to the great Dame Helen Mirren. And she is coming to the stage starting February 15th at the Gielgud Theatre in a play called The Audience. Now, what's interesting about this, of course, is that Dame Helen won the Oscar and every other award going, and in fact, lots of awards that hadn't been invented prior to this role, for her performance as HRH, the Queen, in the movie The Queen, written by Peter Morgan. And in The Audience, she plays the Queen. But what's interesting was, the movie The Queen was Elizabeth II at a very, very particular time in and around the death of Diana and so on. This is totally different. This is a look at the 40 or more years of the Queen's weekly audience at Buckingham Palace with the Prime Minister of the day. And so obviously Dame Helen will have to age appropriately across the evening, and there will be a travelator of actors playing politicians.
That should be an interesting watch as well, for all the different PMs, right?
Yes. Well, the wonderful Hayden Gwynn, who I love, she was on stage in Billy Elliot, the musical, does a lot of TV. She's playing Mrs. Thatcher. So you're going to have a Mrs. Thatcher, impersonator stroke actress, a Queen of the Realm impersonator stroke actress. It should be an interesting challenge. It's also being directed by Stephen Daldry, another name exactly like Sam Mendes, who began in the theatre, mm-hmm. segued to movies, now back in the theatre.
And this has got a lovely kind of, feels like it's being set up for a nice dual element. I guess I was thinking of Margaret Thatcher and the Queen sitting in the same room, both being not unimportant women in the same room. I'm kind of thinking I've got a Frost-Nixon vibe from this, which is so wonderful on the stage.
Well, and it's exactly the same playwright.
Yeah.
So it comes from the same person. The thing about Peter Morgan is he sort of cornered the market in what famous people said to each other, which we can't really verify, but this is what we think. And he's done a lot of that sort of thing, usually around Tony Blair. Tony Blair was, for a while, his pivot, as in Frost-Nixon, and elsewhere, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown. But here, he's imagining, you know, the Queen again with a whole slew of politicians. So what he's doing is widening his canvas much more broadly than he's ever done before.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I think the audience has whetted my appetite more than the other ones so far. But we're going to end with The Weir, Matt.
The Weir is a really beautiful haunting play, a literally haunting play, because it's about a haunting. It's by Conor McPherson, the Irish writer. It was a great success, I think 1997, if I remember correctly, in London and then on Broadway. It's set entirely in a rural Irish pub. A bunch of guys sitting around over a pint or two or ten telling ghost stories. And they're just trying to kind of outscare one another. And then the one woman in the assemblage tells her story, and it turns out to be true. And that is the plot of the play.
I'm really scared. I've got goosebumps, genuinely, just thinking about that.
Yeah, it's a lovely play.
And there's nothing more scary than something scary on the stage, for
yes,
some reason.
Yes, that's right, because you're
right there.
You're being truly haunted in front of your eyes.
Matt Wolfe, I love talking to you. We could have talked right up until 7 o'clock. Unfortunately, we've got to stop there. Matt Wolfe from the International Herald Tribune. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Ron.
You're tuned in to Midori House. It's 1846 in London, and we're going to talk about H&M in a minute.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalizing the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on Monocle.com.
All right, it's 1848 here in London, and you're back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Swedish clothing retailer H&M, a stalwart in the more affordable end of fashion, is branching out into the high-end market. Already well known for collaborations with designers like Stella McCartney and Versace, H&M will be calling their new high-end fashion line And Other Stories. We want to know why this Swedish company is branching out away from their tried and tested model. And joining me now on the line is Ashma Kunde, retail analyst from Euromonitor. Ashma, thanks for joining us.
There.
We normally, as we said in the introduction, hear of high-end designers slamming it on the high street with the likes of H&M. How's it going to work the other way around?
Well, I think recently we've seen a lot of these more high street brands trying to enter the luxury space. We've seen Gap's recent acquisition of luxury boutique Intermix and Fast Retailing, which owns Uniqlo, entering with the acquisition of luxury brand J Brand. But with H&M, I think it's really brave that they've chosen to enter by creating a whole new brand rather than through acquisition.
And do we have any ideas of what And Other Stories is going to look like, what it's going to feel like, any of the sort of fabrics, any of the vibe of these stores and the stuff they're going to be selling?
Well, we haven't really had a chance to look at the products, but judging by the promotional videos that are currently up online, they really seem to be focusing on the details and the craftsmanship, displaying a much more artistic approach to fashion, which is really interesting because it goes against the whole fast fashion trend-driven movement, which lies at the core of the H&M brand.
They're not just opening, they're opening on Regent Street here in London, but they're also opening in Barcelona, Berlin, Copenhagen, Milan, Paris and Stockholm. These are all kind of quite fashion-forward cities. Everybody or most of the fine burgers of those cities have got a few quid in their pockets. Are we going to likely see these stores rolled out in the Regent Street equivalent of those other cities?
I can only imagine so, because I think in the more upmarket end of the market, retail location is definitely going to be a key part. And also this whole limited distribution strategy, so limiting the number of stores they're placing in these markets, definitely aligned with the higher end of the market.
And what about the name and other stories? We didn't stumble over it in our introduction, did we, quite? But it's H&M is such a brand, isn't it, Ashma? I wonder how and other stories translates. Is it trip easily off the tongue?
I think it really plays well into their promotional videos because they've kind of added it as a suffix to the end of all of the things. And the whole ethos of the brand is for consumers to create their own stories and live their own stories through the clothes.
And do you think there's a chance for the branding of this label and other stories to be something different? As you said, they're encouraging people to tell different stories. Is there going to be a big, or can you see a big sort of social media element to the way that this brand is sold to people?
Yes, definitely. And I also think that the simultaneous launch of its e-commerce site alongside its retail locations is definitely going to be a positive aspect for the brand. Being online from the onset is definitely going to help and also further the brand awareness globally.
Ashma Kunde, we're going to watch this space and other stories is premiering soon. We'll watch the retail space with interest. Ashma, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to have a song now. We're going to keep it in the Nordic region. This is Anna Brun from a Midori House session last year. This is Do You Remember?
Do you remember the late morning when we went back to bed? When we found our first position and every muscle rested? I do remember that I already knew it was the last time. The last time for first positions, the last time you're being mine. Do you remember the scars I showed you, the stories I told you? How I always said forever when you asked me to stay true. Do you remember how we forgot how to smile at each other, to believe that the other wants only what's good for you? Oh.
with some fine plucking and polite applause. That was Anna Brune with Do You Remember from last year's Midori House session. And at 1854, you're tuned in to Midori House. Every week, we visit a neighbour here in Marylebone or in the neighbourhoods by one of our bureaus around the world. This week, we hear from Johnson, who was one of the first small businesses to move into Star Street area in Wan Chai, where our Hong Kong bureau is located. From the first trickle of customers having Hong Kong milk tea and French toast early in the morning to the busy lunch hour and until late, Johnson is there serving up the neighbourhood's most liked and loved local fare.
Johnson.
My name is Johnson. I'm the owner of the restaurant Dak Yu. My father founded the restaurant in 1954. After he passed away 30 years ago, the family took over the business under my elder brother's leadership. Now I run it. It's been a roadside restaurant called Dai Pai Dong in Cantonese since the beginning. In the 1970s, we decided to expand our business and moved into this space here on St. Francis Yard in Wan Chai. We have been running the business from here ever since. We mainly offer tea and coffee, but at lunchtime we also serve fried rice and noodles. We've got lots of dishes that have become favourites among our customers, such as our Indonesian fried rice, a speciality by our chef who's originally from Malaysia, and our Hong Kong-style milk tea, renowned for its silky texture, hasn't changed its flavour since the 1950s. People working in this area tend to have lunch here every day because we offer good food with affordable prices. That's our competitive edge. This area has been experiencing big changes over the past few years. It used to be a poor area. Now it's very middle class. In the 1950s and 60s, it was just a residential area. After that, many garages moved in. Now it's a place with lots of trendy clothing shops. In the past, our customers were all neighbours or people from poorer backgrounds. Now there are many office workers that are highly educated eating here. Some of our customers are attracted here because it's a scenic spot. In Hong Kong, traditional tea restaurants like ours are vanishing. Those that remain have pushed their prices up and quality has gone down. Rent is the biggest problem. Many tea restaurants, some even with Michelin stars, couldn't keep going because they couldn't afford the rising rents. Luckily, we have a good relationship with our landlord, and therefore we don't have to face those kinds of pressures. I have no children, and all my siblings' children have their own businesses, and none of them want to take over the restaurant. I'll keep it running as long as my health allows me to do so.
And that was Johnson from the Wan Chai neighbourhood in Hong Kong. And that's almost all, folks. Thanks to our producer, Phil Hahn, and our studio manager, Ben Jay. Up next, after the news, is this week's episode of The Menu. Today, they talk luxury toothpicks with founder of the Canadian company, Danison.
The wood is very clean. The grain is very straight. There's no tooth in the grain. It's smooth. It's strong. It won't splinter and break. There's all these sort of funny, sort of nuanced, detailed things.
Very nice. Midori House will be back at the same time on Monday. Don't forget to tune in to tomorrow's newest episode of The Stack, where Andrew Tuck is joined by photojournalist Lindsay Adario and John Owen, Professor of International Journalism at City University. And thank you very much for listening. It leaves me all to say thanks for tuning in.